Today, Into the Unknown, the DFA Daily to the 29th of July, 2020. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour and with a touch of philosophy on the side. The Consumer Price Index fell 1.9% in the June 2020 quarter, according to the latest data from the ABS. This was the largest quarterly fall in the 72-year history of the CPI. The June quarter fall was mainly the result of free childcare, down 95%, a significant fall in the price of automotive fuel, down 19.3%, and a fall in preschool and primary education, down 16.2%, with free preschool being provided in New South Wales, Victoria, and Queensland. Excluding these three components, the CPI would have risen 0.1% in the June quarter. And some CPI components recorded notable price rises on the back of increased spending. For example, cleaning and maintenance products were up 6.2%. Other non-durable household products, which includes toilet paper, up 4.5%, furniture up 3.8%, major household appliances up 3%, and audio and visual and computing equipment up 1.8%. The annual inflation rate was down 0.3% in the year to June 2020. Since 1949, this was only the third time annual inflation has been negative. The previous times were in 1962 and in 1997 to 98. COVID-19 impacted a range of CPI components in the June quarter. And the ABS includes an analytical series which provides alternative measures of underlying inflation in the economy. These measures, namely the trend mean and weighted mean, aim not to measure the size of inflation which is captured by the headline figure, but the breadth of price inflation across the basket of consumer goods and services. The purpose of these measures is to exclude unusually large price movements in both directions of just a few of the subgroups, which may have quite an impact on the headline CPI. By excluding these outliers, you can get a feel for how widespread across the consumer basket inflation really is. And according to the ABS, the trimmed mean and weighted median measures came in above the headline result at minus 0.1% and 0.1% respectively over the June quarter. And over the year, the trimmed mean and weighted median rose by 1.2% and 1.3%. And ahead, the details of the June quarter CPI suggest that the underlying inflationary momentum has softened in a material way, but even if we see the expected significant bounce in Q3 associated with the unwinding of government assistance packages, it will not be enough to drive a meaningful lift in underlying inflationary momentum. So the RBA has once again failed. But I'd also make the point that the CPI is completely unconnected from the real experience of households in our surveys who continue to argue that their cost of living have risen. In fact, almost all households in our survey say over the last 12 months, the real costs have risen significantly stronger than the CPI. And a new survey from Rate City suggests that more than one quarter of borrowers with a deferred mortgage will not be able to resume repayments once holidays end, with a similar proportion claiming they will consider selling their home. Come September, when the six-month mortgage deferral period ends, only those in severe financial hardship can apply for a four-month extension. The others will have to resume repayments. Of those who have deferred repayments, 28% said they won't be able to or don't know if they're able to resume their repayments. Weighing their options, 67% say they hope their bank will give them an extension, 25% may switch to interest-only repayments, and another 25% will consider selling their home. And 70% will look at borrowing money from family, and 8% may rent out their home and live somewhere cheaper. And the Australian Banking Association says the four-month extension will not be automatic and will be reserved for those in the most severe hardship. Rate City Research Director Sally Tyndall says there is a lot of uncertainty around the end of the initial six-month deferral period. Lots of people are unsure what they're going to do, and that's a worry, she said. Now, the Australian Prudential Regulatory Authority has updated its capital management guidelines for banks and insurers, and in particular, easing restrictions around paying dividends as institutions continue to manage the disruption caused by COVID-19. APRA's updated guidance replaces its recommendations in April this year that banks and insurers seriously consider deferring decisions on the appropriate level of dividends until the outlook is clearer. Uncertainty in the economic outlook has reduced somewhat since then, they said, and APRA has had the opportunity to review banks and insurers' financial projections and stress testing results. Taking these and other developments since April into account, APRA has today written to banks and insurers advising that they should maintain caution in planning capital distributions, including dividend payments. In additional guidance for the banking sector, APRA has indicated that for the remainder of the calendar year, boards should seek to retain at least half of their earnings when making decisions on capital distributions and utilise dividend reinvestment plans and other initiatives to offset the diminution of capital from capital distribution where possible, conduct regular stress testing to inform decision making and demonstrate ongoing lending capacity, and to make use of capital buffers to absorb the impact of stress and continue to lend to support households and businesses. APRA Chair Wayne Byers said the updated guidance balanced the needs of banks and insurers to keep supporting households and businesses while also maintaining a prudent approach in the face of very sharp and severe economic contractions. Today's announcement strikes a balance in recognising the strength of the financial system while at the same time acknowledging the difficult path ahead, he said. Although the environment remains one of heightened risk, we now have a stronger sense of how Australia's economy and financial institutions are being impacted by COVID-19. On that basis, APRA believes that banks and insurers do not need to continue to defer capital distributions, provided they moderate payments to sustainable levels based on robust stress testing and continue to prioritise supporting their customers and the economy. In the current environment, banks face additional challenges in their capital resilience, including the material volume of loan repayment deferrals, which are subject at present to regulatory concessions, greater financial impact from COVID-19, and restrictions on dividends from their New Zealand operations. APRA has therefore set an expectation that dividend payout ratios for ADIs will be maintained below 50% for this year. APRA's letter to ADIs also highlights the importance of utilising current capital buffers to absorb losses and meet the needs of customers. The years spent building up the capital strength of Australia's banking sector to historical highs has been precisely for a time such as this. Further, APRA is committed to ensuring any rebuild of capital buffers, if required, will be conducted in an orderly manner, he said. Now, the RBA, of course, introduced term funding facilities to lower borrowing costs and support lending. The TFF does this by providing a guaranteed source of funding to ADIs for 3 years at the low cost of 25 basis points, with an incentive to increase lending to businesses, especially small and medium-sized enterprises. Funds provided under the TFF are secured against collateral, as is the case with the bank's other facilities. They said the other day that despite only part of the funding being drawn down to date, it's worth noting that the TFF, combined with the bank's other policy measures, has already had a significant impact on the funding side. The ability to draw on the TFF means that banks can be selective in how they raise money, and this has contributed to overall bank funding costs falling by around 60 basis points since February. And on the lending side, we've also seen interest rates on new fixed-rate mortgages fall by around 65 basis points since February, and rates on SME loans fall by around 60 basis points. Now, let's be clear. Cheap money from the government and the RBA are flowing into the banks, and this is allowing banks to pay dividends, and the RBA is encouraging banks to lend more to businesses and households at a time of economic uncertainty and high indebtedness. This is the real Ponzi scheme, of which the housing market is just a small part. And here is another one. Domain reported that the Berejiklian government will cut land tax for the next 20 years for new builds to rent housing projects in an Australian first, designed to give renters longer term leases. New South Wales will give a 50% discount on land tax to developers who invest in build-to-rent schemes, which are designed to provide better quality rental properties and long tenancy arrangements. Treasurer Dominic Perriott said the scheme would provide more housing options, greater certainty for renters, boost construction and support jobs during the COVID-19 recovery. Build to rent is popular overseas, but still in its infancy in Australia. And we want to remove the barrier and allow this segment of the market to grow, he said. And he also said the tax cut would encourage build to rent developments by ensuring that they are subject to similar overall amounts of state tax as comparable to build to sell developments. An exemption from foreign investor surcharges will also be provided until 2040. And the range of integrity measures will be included to ensure discounts are not used for tax avoidance. Legislation for the land tax will be introduced this week into Parliament. And the government also is exhibiting a new planning policy that includes proposed development standards for build-to-rent projects across the state. It would include design guidance on context and character, sustainability and amenity. And Planning Minister Rob Stokes said the proposed changes would simplify planning controls to support investment in diverse and affordable housing types, including build-to-rent, co-living, social and student housing. Now, what a time to flood the market with more rental property when we have oversupply. They should have focused on business and infrastructure investment, but no, it's more construction sector support, just as we've seen in other states, just as property investors are starting to throw in the towel. Now, gold, of course, and silver have been motoring, and AMP Shane Oliver unpicked it today. Until the early 1970s, the US dollar was fixed against gold. This was subject to periodic devaluation, such as in 1934. From the early 1970s to 80s, gold was in a secular upswing as investors turned to gold for protection against inflation. However, from 1980 to 1999, gold was in a secular downtrend as inflation was brought under control. The 2000s saw gold enter another secular upswing in line with other commodities, and despite a brief interruption at the time of the GFC, this got a further push along with the Eurozone debt crisis and more central bank monetary easing into 2011, which saw gold peak at $1,921 US in 2011. But this gave way as global growth improved, with gold falling into 2015. However, since then, gold has surged again and has now surpassed its 2011 high, albeit it's yet to take out its 1980 price peak in real terms of $819 in today's prices, albeit it was just a one-week spike. Now, along with the fall in the US dollar, several other factors have helped push the price of gold up. First, some have been buying gold as a hedge against inflation on the basis that quantitative easing, which involves using printed money to buy financial assets, will generate higher consumer price inflation. Second, gold is seen as a good alternative to major paper currencies, which some see may be at risk thanks to renewed money printing and surging public debt levels. Notably, on this front, gold has risen against most currencies. Third, and perhaps most importantly, the opportunity cost of holding gold versus cash or government bonds as an alternative store of value has collapsed again, thanks to the renewed collapse in interest rates and bond yields. Gold likely has more upside until central banks start to tighten and bond yields rise significantly, which looks to be a while away. Some might see the surge in gold prices as a bad sign, but given the mixed factors driving it higher, it's ambiguous as to whether it's good or bad. But the fall in the US dollar is more clearly a positive than a negative in terms of what it signals about the global economy and falling safe haven demand from investors. So the question is, should investors consider gold? Well, there are a number of ways to get exposure to gold. All have their pros and cons. Physical gold gives pure exposure, but it's costly to store. Gold futures, there's no storage problem there, and it's easy to leverage up, but needs to roll future contracts over as they expire. There's gold exchange-traded funds, which are highly liquid but do involve counterparty risk. And then there are gold shares, which reflect gold prices but are also affected by the performance of the individual companies, or gold funds, which provide an exposure to gold. These may reflect a combination of any of the above. But it's worth stressing, he says, that gold is highly speculative. It's not grounded by an income stream like most shares, property, bonds and cash. Virtually all the gold ever produced still exists and can potentially come back onto the market. At the same time, actual production and demand for jewellery and industrial use is trivial relative to the huge gold stock. As a result, animal spirits can play a huge role in the determination of the gold price, and this can make for a volatile rise, and history has shown that the gold price goes through long-term upswings and downswings. So overall, we think there may be a role for gold in investors' portfolios as a hedge against major paper currency weakness and inflation, but it should be limited, he says, to maybe no more than 5%, depending on investor circumstances. But I think he fails to make the really strong link, and that is between the metal markets, which are highly manipulated, and the interplay between that physical market and the derivatives, which continues to mess with the price. And in fact, these markets are so manipulated, it's very hard to see what's really going on. Longer term also, the question is, will we get inflation or deflation? If we do get inflation, then sure, gold is certainly a hedge. But if we get deflation, not inflation, then metals may well come back. So whilst there are some short-term positives here, it does really depend on your longer-term view of how things may play out. And therefore, those people who keep writing to me and saying, see you were wrong on gold, I simply say, let's wait and see. Give it 2 or 3 years, and then we'll know. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.